Thanks. It's for many reasons, Dr. Scalapino is a very hard act to follow, but even more so that I'm giving a talk that from microscopics takes you more or less in the realm of Ginzburg-Landau. So about us.
That means we will believe it, though.
Well, this means that I have more parameters that nobody can tell me that they can't be what I want them to be. And this is, and the reason this is work which is now in progress, this is done with Zohar Nusinov and Sasha Balatsky. Part of it appeared on the web about, let's see, is that the thing? Yes. Part of it appeared on the web last fall, and some of the results I'm going to tell you about is work in progress. The only reason I'm bringing it up today is essentially because I think it's relevant to the topics that we were discussing, and the message of what I'm going to tell you today is essentially that when we talk about various inhomogeneous states and possibly glassy behavior, as we've heard in many experiments, it can appear not only because of disorder, but as a result of either competing orders or competing interactions. And this is the work which builds heavily on a recent series of papers by Jörg Schmalian and Peter Volinus, and goes back to Sergei Brazovsky's work of about 30 years ago, and as I said, we followed on that in a slightly different fashion. So, again, to introduce you, to remind you what we've heard about today in the last week and a half, is that in Manganites, well, I was here in April for the quantum phase transition workshop, where the same was said of heavy fermions and cuprates. We see various coexistence and competition of different orders, and what experimentally we see, at least in some of the sample, is that there are inhomogeneities on some scales which are not quite atomic but not quite macroscopic, somewhere in between. And there are various ways we can get it in theory. We can get it from disorder, we can get it from competing interactions, and what I'm going to tell you about today is that we can get these effects from competing orders, and since I'm not going to do the microscopic calculation, I will start with the Ginzburg-Landau theory and ask myself how I would get such a situation. And let me, yes? Well, I mean, in the context of cuprate, what do you think doping is? It's disorder. At the same time, it's there. You can't get superconductivity, so it might very well be intrinsic. It depends on the system you're talking about. So. So let me just remind you the sort of results that we all know, and some of them were shown in the talks over the last week and a half. If I just consider a situation where there are two order parameters, and they have their own transition temperatures, and they just don't like coexisting together, right? They locally, they don't like being at the same spot. I can have two possibilities. If this repulsion is not too strong, imagine that I'm tuning the mean field transition temperatures, I can have some regime of coexistence. This is known from the supersolid ideas in liquid helium. Or alternatively, if this competition is too strong, I can get a first-order transition where they don't like coexisting and one essentially expels the other. So I can have only one of them at a given time. Now, we also know this phase diagram has been put in a few talks here, that if I do include the disorder, what it might do, it might push the two competing orders slightly apart, introducing a glassy phase somewhere in between. This is Elbia Dagotto's work, and I think the reason I put several years here is because this is taken from a science paper, which is more recent than the original phase diagram. So the question that I'm going to ask today is whether I can get some inhomogeneities or inhomogeneous coexistence of orders in a nominally uniform system. And of course, if you want to do that at the level of Ginzburg-Landau, you know what you need to do. You need to introduce some couplings which couple the gradients of the order parameters together, or couple gradients to the amplitudes. And at about the same time as our paper, there was a related idea appeared, which by now has been published in Nature by Peter Littlewood and his group in context of manganites, where they said that imagine that I have two order parameters. One of these you should think of as magnetization. The other will be, for example, charge density. And then the phase of this can be linked to the particular wave vector, which is related to the doping. In their case, I think this Q0 was half minus x, and they argued that there shouldn't be any symmetry with respect to x1 equal 1 half. But so this is specific for manganites, and that provides for some inhomogeneities in the orders. However, this is a very specific case, because for general symmetries of the order parameters, I can't write this type of the term. So the question is, what can I write? And of course, the most obvious thing that you could do is to write the coupling of the gradient of one to the amplitude of the other. And this is fully symmetric, so in principle, this coefficient I'm allowed to choose, since I'm doing Ginzburg-Landau, I'm allowed to choose it negative. And this is what I'm going to do in the remainder of this talk. Now, of course, I will need to introduce the higher order gradients to stabilize this, not to get inhomogeneities with an arbitrary large Q. And so, by and large, I'll be considering the Ginzburg-Landau functional, that is essentially functional density, is written here at the bottom. This is the term I was talking about. And I have quite a few parameters. I've chosen, I guess, four of them, because I can rescale energy, I can rescale length, and I can rescale both fields. So I can choose four of these to be whatever I like. But the rest of them are free parameters of the theory, and I need to think about what happens. It doesn't have to be. I can add it symmetric and put these two different... Yeah, I can write another term, grad phi 2 squared, phi 1 squared, but the coefficients need not be the same. Again, I'm for simplicity, as I said, since I have enough complications here, but we actually considered, in the paper we published, we considered both. Sorry? For now, yes, I'm considering scalar order parameters.
So you're saying if phase A is 0, phase B doesn't want to be homogeneous.
Exactly.
So
I think...
What if phase B want to be homogeneous to gains?
Well, let me just... hold on. Phase A and B meaning 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
But, well, for example, let me give... we know that if I think about something like stripes, usual stripes that we talked about, the charges that are ordering like to sit at the domain walls of the antiferromagnet. I mean, that's how life works. So this is not a completely crazy arbitrary choice of the functional. I know that there is at least one situation where one order likes to sit where the other one changes rapidly. So that...
Oh, A is negative.
A is negative.
Oh, okay.
That's what I said here. Right. Yeah, precisely. So this is the model I'm considering. So let me just, for the simplest case, now I have two order parameters with their own mean field transition temperature. Let me illustrate in a very simple case why I would get some non-trivial inhomogeneous solutions. Imagine that one of them onset at a higher temperature, significantly higher temperature than the second. And so I'm going to investigate what happens to this order parameter where this thing is already substantial. Then effectively what I have here, I have a negative gradient square term for this order parameter phi 1. And that, in that situation, the model is very similar to what people studied in soft condensed matter in the context of surfactants. Surfactants are things that like to sit, for example, in oil-water mixture. They like to sit in the interface, and they promote the interfaces. And this is exactly what this term does in this situation. And so from numerical simulations of these classical models, we know that what happens is there is a proliferation at various inhomogeneous phases. All these three figures are borrowed, except I changed the slightly what's on the axis to make it more readable. There is a proliferation of inhomogeneous phases. The structure factor is peaked at a finite k, at the shell of a finite k. And the dynamics is very slow, meaning that if you look at the domain size, it grows logarithmically with temperature. And so from this numerical simulation, you can think already that, well, first of all, you can see that the coexistence is inhomogeneous, the dynamics is slow, and it's possibly glassy. Now, well, no, they look at the model where this thing is constant, effectively. It's a one-order parameter with a negative gradient term, which is that's the surfactant density multiplying the gradient between the two phases. But effectively, that's why in this limit, the models are the same, because one of the order parameters is effectively saturated. I mean, I don't need to worry about both of them changing at the same time. So I'll get to that. So now, if I do that more formally, I'm going to write an effective model for only the order parameter I'm following now. And exactly because of this competition, because the gradient term is negative, I want it to be peaked at a particular k vector that is selected by the coefficients of the Ginzburg-Landau, what I will find is that the Bayer quadratic term has a minimum on a shell of a particular radius around that point. And this changes rather weakly with temperature around the transition temperature for the phi 1 phase. And this is exactly the model that has been considered by Brazovsky 30 years ago. And what he showed, that because I have now a shell of minimizing mode rather than just one point, there is a fairly large phase space for fluctuations. If I just consider the mean phi squared fluctuations for this order, I will find that they will diverge as the bare mass or the bare or the temperature approaches the mean field transition temperature. What happens is in classical limit they will diverge as 1 over square root. The divergence is slightly weaker in the quantum limit. However, the point is that these fluctuations will strongly drive the system away from the transition. This can be formalized in the large n limit. Imagine that now my phi has n components, and then I know that the leading order of the self-energy to order 1 over n is given by this loop diagram. And that makes essentially, in large n limit, the phase transition impossible. Because if you look at this self-consistency equation, r equals 0 corresponds to the phase transition, and I can't satisfy it because I have the divergence in the fluctuation term. Now, of course, this is large n. For some finite n, one would expect that the higher order corrections will make the transition temperature significantly below the mean field TC, but perhaps still finite. However, this does not preclude the first order transition. The same fluctuations that forbid you to have a second order transition promote a first order transition. And Brazovsky showed that at the mean field level, this occurs into kind of a lamellar phase, that the modulation that the system selects is a one-dimensional modulation. It's more advantageous than multiple wave vectors, and gives this kind of the stripy, lamellar, whatever one chooses, phase. Now, in this problem in principle now, if I follow the temperature development of this mass term, or rather proximity to the transition, together with the wave vector, there are two length scales. And this was first shown by Nusinov and co-workers a few years ago. One of them effectively controls the short-range order appearing, and the other controls the long-range correlations between these short-range orders. And so they diverge at very different temperatures, because one of them has the plus sign here, the other has minus, for a given Q. Now, what has been shown later on by Jörg Schmalian and Peter Wollners, that if at any point, as I march down in temperature, it so happens that the correlation length becomes twice this modulation length that controls the short-range order, this means that the system might become glassy. The configuration entropy becomes extensive. If I'm wrong, Jörg will correct me. And therefore, in that case, the natural conclusion is that the system might become glassy. So the bottom line is that if my transition temperatures are well separated, there are two possible scenarios. There is either a fluctuation in just first order transition or glassiness. In principle, if I just look at the model where I have a fixed, let's say, negative gradient square term, and I stabilized it by grad squared squared term, it will follow at some lower temperature by a very strong first order transition to a homogeneous phase, because there is another part in the free energy that doesn't like the inhomogeneities. There is too much energy to be lost in the uniform condensation energy. Now, so there might be another transition there where I'm not sure how applicable Ginzburg-Landau that we are using is, because this happens at fairly large values of the negative values of parameter R. Now, for as I bring the temperatures close together, what happens is the drive to modulate one of the order parameters, that it depends on the amplitude of the order parameter phi 2, onsets further and further below the mean field transition temperature. In that situation, what we find, this is something that we haven't finished yet investigating, but what we find for now is that typically there will be a first order transition into the modulated phase once the amplitude of this inhomogeneous term becomes large enough, once the prefactor of an inhomogeneous term becomes large enough. And the question that is still open as we go down in temperature, do we ever cross this line where the glassy behavior may occur or not? At this point, I don't know the answer to this question. This is something we're investigating for now.
You want to address that question? I mean, if you compare energies, you will always find that also what you're finding in glycerol, so like ordinary glass, but at some temperature, the crystal will be more stable than the liquid. That's where you should have your first order of fixed energy.
Absolutely. However,
so the question whether you reach the glassiness. It's not a question of energetics, it's a question of kinetics.
I agree. But in this particular situation, right, when you look at glycerin, you have an input density of the surfactant, which controls your gradients. Mm-hmm. In this case, because this is the order parameter that is not conserved, right, it grows below the transition temperature. So it's not just the density that comes in, local density comes there. It can become large as I go below the mean field transition temperature. And in that case, I think the kinematics will be slightly different as well. But again, I don't know yet the firm answer to that question. But it's somewhat different model. That's why I separated. The case when the two mean field transition temperatures are different maps almost exactly on what you said. As they become closer, the fact that I have this non-conserving order parameter becomes essential. So that's the parent status, and the message again that I'm with which I'm going to finish is the point relevant to experimental observations is that you can get modulated inhomogeneous and possibly glassy phases in systems that don't even have disorder nominally, or you can get them for reasons other than having a disorder. And at the level of Ginzburg-Landau, details matter, and I have quite a few order parameters. And so what is essential now, and what we're planning to do, is essential to ask, well, do we have a Hamiltonian? Do we have a well-defined Hamiltonian on which one can do mean field theory, derive Ginzburg-Landau, including the gradient terms, and obtain, for example, the terms of the terms driving inhomogeneity along the lines of what I told you about? In particular, there were two talks already at this workshop which gave hints that one can try to do this type of work, and these is the Alvarez and Bill Atkinson talks, who looked exactly at that. They took a very complicated Hamiltonian, which allows for different types of orders, just modeled them numerically, and found some proliferation of inhomogeneously coexistent phases. So in both cases, it would be interesting to look at what happens to Ginzburg-Landau, but this is again something for the future. And since we'll have a discussion on inhomogeneities this afternoon, and I'm not sure where we're going to have it. Okay. And since I'm going to lead this discussion and therefore will not give myself the right to speak too much, I'm going to, you can treat it as kind of an opening round of the discussion, and we'll continue now with questions and later in the afternoon. Thanks. Yes, I mean, because the only time I get the inhomogeneity, because of the structure of the term, it's amplitude of one order parameter, gradient the other. So I only get this in the coexistence regime. Yeah.
How do you actually define glassiness in this specific model?
Well, I just, the way I argued about it, there is a certain regime where I can map it on Brzozowski transition, which you have solved for me.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, explicitly using the same
Yeah, for the TC is very close. Yes. I'm not entirely sure.
I think this seems to be the four-glassman defect method type of argument.
Right.
That's why you model is really different and interesting.
Yes. Yeah, it's worth doing. I'm not... Okay, let's do it tomorrow. Yeah, but definitely we should sit down and talk, because you've done it with very different approaches in several papers.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether I know which approach, for example, is the best suited for a particular thing. Okay.
This is a question more directed at Gonzalo, if the speaker will allow, just because you brought up this point. In the unbiased Monte Carlo approach, take away the disorder. Do you have a fund take to this site? Okay, so you would say that what they need to do is maybe use the Ginsburg-Landau approach as a way of investigating parameter space to figure out where they can get something interesting of this type that's intrinsic?
Well,
we also can get the, we only get consistent. Over the Ginsburg-Landau, you can get both first order.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know if you haven't explored all the parameters. It's feasible that there's some other interesting image model, right?
Yeah, we don't have that many parameters, but we have explored systematic and we haven't found work at all.
Okay.
But maybe follow up on what Gonzalo is saying. The calculations that we have done, they indeed find these homogeneous states which look like stripes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a glass, it's true, but there is many of the things you said are in those calculations. So it's, and maybe a little extra of quench disorder will make the stripe look like a glass.
Might pin it, actually, a little bit of disorder and change the kinematics.
That we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
So if you take disorder to zero,
that's correct. That's an important point of the talk of Gonzalo. In the clean limit, there are places in the phase diagram where you get these modulations, totally without disorder. It's, you know, we cannot call that directly a glass. You see a very nice irregularity.
Are they periodic?
They are very
periodic.
Yeah, within the limitations of the simulation, they look like that. Yeah.
So it's about the origin of the Landau functional that you're writing down. So you argue, I mean, the same that you made, let's say, and I guess in connection with stripes, that where the anti-Fermat change of sign, assuming it's collinear in the sign base, it's k-loaded parameters, and that's where you have bilateral of the charge, which you know is k-loaded parameter. For exactly the same kind of situation, in fact, Kibbleson and company, they propose different coupling mechanism, right? I mean, not mechanism, at the level of Ginsburg-Landau, it was repulsion between m squared, which is minimization, and density.
Yeah, that's
so
the.
Do you have an argument which one is better?
Yes, I think they have an argument which one is better, actually. If I just keep this term, which is the last term in the top line, right? This is the local repulsion.
No, they have
the density. Well, phi squared is a density, essentially. Whether it's m or m squared is just, you know, m, you're not allowed. Because in that case, from what I recall from Kittleson's work, you get a phase separation. If I'm correct, if that's the work that you're citing, there is a little paper by Pretko and, I think they found that if you just have essentially the non-gradient type coupling, you will find a phase separation. And therefore, you need something of that type to promote inhomogeneous states.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the claim was that there is coupling between Q spin modulation and 2Q charge modulation.
Oh, this was given in the 4-4.
No, but that's just spin order driving charge order. That's.
Cast microscopic models on the Ginsburg-Landau, maybe there is already seed of these negative gradient terms.
You mean the attraction between gradient?
Right. Which is a sort of natural, you know, we have a lot of this kink, like, you know, this solid constant polyacetylene where the charge is sitting on the kinks are kind of
by this place and they see try to deal in with the very potential domain move and where the Chinese want to be localized. Actually, in this context, I think South Poland people are looking at the Spielberg model, but they're forcing the superconducting world according to the five phase shape. We find that there is a lot of the dependence of the point particles for the cluster for the main walls and
you're talking about glassy states. Wouldn't you want to enhance on this approach by having time dependence? Since you want to know about time double primes or whatever, and just actually say something about glassy?
Well, that's precisely was York's question, and the example I gave, which maps onto what has already been done, that is precisely has been done in Schmalian and Volner's papers. For the situation where the temperature dependence of this coefficient in front of the gradient is important, I'm not sure whether I don't think the dynamics, the kinematic sort of glassy transition has been obtained. So whether in that case one gets just a first order transition or a glass, I don't know. In the other case, when you separate them, I didn't talk about it because the work essentially has been done not by me but before, and I can just appeal to it, saying that the kinematic argument has been obtained. That's honestly, I did not when I was writing this, but I think it's probably right that one should do both, because there is a dynamics of the order parameter that doesn't come from this macroscopic coexistence. There is a sort of dynamics that comes from microscopic Hamiltonian, right? I mean, if I have two order parameters, they influence each other. I think that this dynamics is separate on some time scales from the kinematics that drives the glassy transition, but it might, I mean, in the situations that I know of, but I'm not sure how universal that statement is. Yeah.
We just saw the time-dependent integral equation with a large notion, and then you find exactly the same criteria for glassiness for the long-time dynamics or from, say, some other statistics.
But I thought that part of the question was that I know, for example, if one of those order parameters is superconducting, in certain dirty cases, the time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau is a good thing, but in the clean cases, there is a more complicated equivalent, which is the integral equation, which you can't separate. And in that case, that's precisely why I was being a little cautious answering that. There are situations when I can't just write the TDGL, which would be mapped on Langevin type equation.
Interfaces and drain boundaries of high temperature superconductors. Certainly, this is a next step in complexity of these highly correlated systems. And so I added a phrase from a theoretician perspective just to tell you I will simplify from our modeling, and certainly I will also focus on certain aspects. Especially in these 15 minutes, I will not be able to cover what I intended. In the beginning, so they'll only talk about electrostatic interface tuning. So these are superconducting field effect devices. and not go to nanomagnetism. I think just since I just mentioned this here in the list, to tell you that there are many more exciting aspects of interface. So next step in complexity, why would we like to go there? If you talk to other physicists, you would say, well, we even don't understand the bulk systems or interfaces. And well, you have to realize really most devices are interface with things of transistors or whatever you want. Certainly, we also have to solve kind of the puzzle how to transport high critical currents to these cables, these metal cables. And the transport is mostly then controlled through frame boundaries in these cases. And there's now certain knowledge about these frame boundaries and how the frame boundaries affect the magnitude of the critical curve. Quite developed. And then, certainly, from a theoretician's perspective, it's exciting possibly to investigate new states at those interfaces. Any minute would possibly talk about electronic construction. It seems there are new states which just live at these interfaces, and certainly then at some point we would like to know about them. Now, field effect devices. Too bad. Actually, the theory group is missing. So, work actually started on this when Peter came with the sabbatical to Augsburg years ago. And that time, Verena Körting was my diploma student. She's now in Karlsruhe, Peter Wölfe. In San Juan, he moved to Houston, Texas. He was in King there, and he did not here. And from the experimental side, it's Jochen Mannert's group in Augsburg. Jena Lock-Venos is now at Brookhaven National Lab. Christoph Schneider is still in Augsburg. So field effect devices, well, we have the simple scheme that on a substrate you put maybe four lattice units of a high-temperature superconductor. And so that would constitute the same source channel, and then you get the system, some dielectric material, like quantum particles. As Nandini already said, the world would be quite simple in that case. You go to the undoped system, and then instead of chemical doping, would just have field doping, and maybe then you can trace various transitions which you can expect for those strong microelectric systems. We will see that the world is much more difficult because you have to take into account certain interfaces that actually take not only in these devices, also if you consider transport to interfaces or same boundaries. There's a long history on field effect. Well, field effect investigations started in basically 1990, I think, for the high temperature superconductors. They expect that green is much less important than in the conventional superconductors. So they expected a much stronger effect. And the first experiment, Tebbert's group, they're quite disappointing. They found a kind of tiny shift of the two in the end. Presumably, this was related to the fact that they used a dielectric state material with there's more dielectric, or not a large dielectric constant. And furthermore, they were close to optimal, and even over the extreme. I will come back to this. There. And then later on, 1991, when Mannert was at Bettenhaus and Müller and IBM lab, they investigated field effects with quantum titanate. states, and they found major shifts in CC, like up to 7,000 at a time. So, positive or negative state science, and you have the effect of doping or removing charges into the superconducting layer. And later on, at this time, you would find CC shifts of the order of 10,000. And quite recently, group in Italy observed also insulator superconducting transitions here. There is a strong negative bias, so in the insulating phase, we will find the super. But it's in total, so negative and positive bias jointly. Usually, there's the asymmetric form, so there's not so much with the negative bias. So positive bias is about the
positive bias, at least here, decreases the carrier. I mean, I just don't know how to do it. Because the red line is not that much large, of course, it's much more water drive.
Okay. Oh, because we are interested in the interface. Yeah. Well, this is what just a little bit above. I think this one is the first option. No, it's no. That's low option. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is electrostatic field tuning feasible? Certainly, it is in the sense that we find these shifts. The aerial charge densities are still pretty small, in the order of 0.01 to 0.05 Kelsius. There's no reason why you shouldn't gain a factor of 4, and maybe they are like at 0.1 now. It's certainly limited by the breakdown voltage of the electric gate. And kind of these are the maximum dielectric constants for films of constant type emulsions. The other materials are not really improved right now. From the theoretical side, there's been also some interesting development on the base then these superconducting field effect devices. Gained a lot of attention. Really important law and price investigated actually the formation of two-dimensional bands at the interface in D60. And it turns out that actually the charge pairs are indeed swept to the interface. So in their kind of simulations, they found that for underdoped systems, about 80% are at the first layer, and in overdose regime, about 100% of the charge layer. So the deal here is with a two-dimensional system of a highly correlated thin metal, and which is next to a dielectric gate that like quantum type of it. Okay. So from an artist's point of view.
The point of the previous slide was that it's feasible to essentially ram all the charges of China in one way.
Yes. Yeah, that's the method. That's the method. Yes. Interactions in the plane and between the planes. So it was kind of after the evaluation of the plane.
It's just an
electrostatic
equation for the given charge
profile. Yes. What do you mean, no quantum mechanics? No, it's not a classical. The evaluation of charge pairs with respect to, basically the C60 band, Coulomb interaction. In the interface and between the different layers. And then, after the kind of string calculation, you The class is basically respect to the first layer, next to the first layer. So what we then would visualize. So and they are up to 10 to the 8 volts per meter. That's about the maximum of 4 times 10 to the 8 volts per meter. Maximum you can attain nowadays. And the electrical breakdown. Actually, that corresponds to about 0.05 error carrier density, the 10 to the 8. So what went into the calculation is then much higher fields. If you start at undoped systems and then really want to go to half-depth systems, that would be then a factor of about 10 more. Just to care about it. If you want to say go from undoped system to a half-doped system. Then it would be about say 10 to the 10 volts per centimeter.
10 to the 10 volts per centimeter, yes. Means what, 100 volts per
okay, so that would be 10 to my
100 volt per angstrom, that's
a lot.
I mean, if you would like to cover the full range, of course, the system. So the systems we consider, we have them doped already and then have a small shift.
Sasha's question is correct, but the top of the molecule and the bottom of the molecule, C60, is completely different. They have a bulk difference across.
No, there are differences between the what really went on in the experiment or in the distribution of the field in the screen. I'm asking what the calculation. In the calculation across the one molecule, how much of a wall difference we get. And if we get on a scale of a wall, how do you deal with this? I presume that's what I understand the sort of question with your work is more about the flow of water, right? I'm very curious about what exactly they get done. Because there is a substantial band banding, and you can throw in a couple of some homogeneities, meaning that should be different C60 molecule sample, very different, they are in different band structure situations. And so how do you select? Ultimately, I guess it fits to your bottom statement that it's feasible.
Well, it's feasible from experiment, as we know. It seems to be feasible. I mean, from a theoretical point of view, it seems to be feasible to reach something like 0.1. X equals 0.1 shift in doping. So we set up the system in the sense that we have, say, our metallic layer, our two electrons hopping at some doping in that metallic layer exclusively, and then next to it the dielectric layer, which we want to visualize in the first step just by, say, dipole excitation. It may be driven either by electric field forming by the charge carriers which move around in the metallic layer. Okay, so more simple view of this. Most important for all the following is electric field energy, which is just an electric field in the side perpendicular to the layers, and say the dipole moment, at least dipoles in the layer. We assume in that simple model that we just have a two-level system in polarized. I will specify this a little bit more further on. And a simple band then in that accumulation we are next to the interface. Okay? So as both of these, quite obvious what we have to include, some band term in the metallic layer, a two-level system in the dielectric layer, same with levels S and P, and then coupling to external fields to just polarization. Okay. On the other hand, just to relate these two layers, we have the interaction through the charges moving here, which polarize the dipoles in the next layer. So that interaction is denoted now by V. And certainly, there are some Coulomb interactions between the electrons in the metallic layer. Let me go just a little step further with the interaction of the metallic layer to that of the dielectric layer. So you introduce transitions of these two-level systems, and it's quite, maybe it's a little bit more easy to visualize them by introducing pseudo spin. So what we do actually here by these charge carriers, you introduce transitions in the transversal channel, but you also introduce here a longitudinal channel. Why? I mean, here it seems to have only transition, so there should be just the S plus S minus, but with the electric field applied, you have to re-diagonalize your two-level system. And when re-diagonalizing your two-level system, you have to kind of transform these original levels, and then there's also this repulsive term between the dipoles and the charge carriers. So the first term, obviously, would then finally lead to a practice interaction of the charge carriers. We'll see this in a moment. It drives vertical transitions to the charge carriers. And the other term here is zero if there's no electric field, because then we are just the bare Hamiltonian diagonal in the two-level system. With the electric field, we are not. So we have to inform this interaction term is proportional to the electric field. You'll see this will introduce a repulsive term in the pairing term. Yeah. Now, steps towards an approximate solution. Basically, two steps, which are quite common for these models. First, bosonize this. Bosonization is valid if the occupation is very small, say the occupation of the upper level. And since we only consider here virtual excitations, we still at very low energies, what we want to consider. This is 10 to the minus 5, so it's kind of exact even. The other step is to get rid of the coupling term between the bosons and the charge carriers. So we do this by that Lanvierstoff transformation. You have to pay a price certainly for this because you get a more complicated kinetic term. So then I'm back to this kinetic term in the end.
The energy of this dual system is much higher than that.
Yes.
So that's why it's large electric field, or?
Well, it just implies that we have to consider dipoles which have that level splitting. And we investigated this a little bit more. The effect of dipoles with very small level splitting is minor to the question we asked about here, superconductivity. And the most important dipoles on this are those of the charge transfer type in Poisson titanate, and they are of the order of 1 to 2 electron volts.
Is there icing
and isotropy? I mean, the
dipoles
are not SU2. No. So, I mean, when you do the calculation, yes. It's the same treatment as SU2 spin? No. So there is some huge icing. Yes. There's no
SU2.
But actually, you don't have to do it. It simplifies a little bit. No. You could even say this. So, without field, in second order perturbation theory, you would all know what we get. So, it's an attractive interaction which is mediated by this dipole. There's a long history. It started obviously in 64 with little work on high temperature superconductivity. I don't want to go into the details now, although it's quite exciting to see how it failed or why it maybe didn't fail in the end. Certainly we don't have this type, or we haven't found so far this type of superconductivity. Nevertheless, it's very much related to what we consider here for the two-dimensional system.
Excitons
in the gate. That's right. They are spatially separated. This is quite important. For instance, of exchange effects and vertical connection. They are well separated from the charge in the metallic layer.
Exciton will be in the place where you have SP
bands
with support.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's in the next layer in the gate. And this is separated by one lattice spacing from the metallic layer. And we have all the charge pairs moving around.
So you have carrier force and SP in the insulator and the
yes.
gate. And the ones that will go in the exotonic will be the ones
that... Well, it's not... No, these are localized.
Right.
I mean, Poisson titanate. So they excite, say, through a charge transfer application.
What I'm trying to get is, are these exotons mobile or not?
No. No, they are certainly not mobile. We know from Poisson titanate that they are not mobile. They are actually trapped.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
No. No. Yeah. Yeah. So, for U equals zero, it's not so tough to evaluate. You see, just after those steps, we do a DCS metering type of evaluation. And what we find is TC, or T versus field energy, a non-monotonous behavior. But non-monotonous, that's quite obvious, because in the first place, TC for small doping is limited by the number of concentration of particles. So we have that little increase here in TC. However, then TC is finally limited by the repulsive term I was talking about here as long as this was in the first place linear in the electric field. There are non-linear terms also. And this finally restricts TC to a certain level. And at the end, the saturation of the dipole moment, so the mechanism is at high field basically gone. And TC goes down to zero. What is quite interesting to note that there's exciting or fascinating dependence on the dipole location gap. turns out for small Dirac expansion, the effect goes down, increases then for increasing Dirac expansion depth, and finally at the order of 4 or 8 T, increases again. And this is kind of a robust feature. It's not very much dependent on the other parameters, on the, like the dielectric constant and the interaction. So this evaluation says you should look for dipole excitations at the order of, say, 1 to 2 electron volts.
Is it
the best way to pair? That's a safe pairing at that moment. And that now to be made clear. Certainly, we want to include the Hubbard term in a decoupling evaluation. This is not so difficult, and as expected, pairing is depressed. It's not so strongly depressed that you wouldn't get a pairing interaction, a pairing mechanism even for the intermediate value. Now, if you want to go to the real materials, you certainly have to take into account strong coupling scenario. So let's take U of the order of 8T and kind of try to map the models in the end on a TJ model. First place, if you think about it, it's very simple. The effect I was talking about is not so tremendously large, so that the local pulse of U will be renormalized by, say, 0.2. So that was the direct interaction I've been talking about. And then the spin exchange interaction would be renormalized quite significantly. The effect in that sense seems to be gone. It does take that purely local scenario into account. On the other hand, I didn't tell you about kinetic terms. Kinetic term is renormalized, actually strongly renormalized. So for that set of parameters, it would go down to 0.7. And if we take into account the field dependence of effective hopping versus field, then certainly at strong fields, it's not renormalized. At strong fields, all the dipoles are saturated. The dipole moment is saturated. So it's the bare bandwidth, but it goes down for smaller fields to the exciton formation. So actually, increasing field will delocalize the charge. If you take into account that renormalization of the kinetic term, so the exciton, certainly we also have to take into account renormalization for phonons. If we are next, say, to a gauge that's constant titanate, you know there's a soft phonon mode. The order of 50 to 18 inverse centimeters, which is related to the closeness of the transition into the ferroelectric state, which doesn't take place in quantum titanate. And so that would have a maybe even dominant effect on renormalization of kinetic energy. So this is then controlled here by the coupling of the charge pair to the phonons, and the energy scale is important here as part of this EP, given by the phonon frequency and coupling, or polaron binding energy. This is, it can be found in major range of values, because it depends on the electron-phonon coupling. They vary depending on the interface separation, so the distance they have to next dielectric layer to the metallic layer. So So in fact, what you find then is a localization transition depending on that coupling, that is depending on that polaron binding energy. It's small, you basically have a minimization here. This is already the spin exchange over bare spin exchange. Sorry, that part is missing. So at low doping, there's no effect, and then suddenly at some doping, in the fine condition. This is not unexpected. A very similar evaluation has been given with what CMR manganite by this group, and their that localization condition is driven by doping. I mean, actually, the parameter which controls the localization transition is the kinetic energy of the charge pairs divided by the whole concentration. It's rather a boring parameter, but these equations are highly nonlinear. So at some point, some doping takes in the localization transition. And so if you go on and then kind of take the most simple evaluation scheme you can think of, Clay-Boson evaluation for the strongly correlated systems. you find that the transition temperatures, which is actually the transition to the superconducting state, is limited here by the Bose condensation of the Clay-Boson and by the pairing transition of the fermions. And if you go down from zero coupling to a finite coupling, there's some renormalization. However, most importantly, at some value of doping, the condition localized state. And if this coupling is now increased, that condition will come at smaller and smaller doping. And finally, and I'll conclude with this one. Now, if you take electric field into account, the very last step, you will find that the transition is controlled not just by doping. It's the question of the fraction of doping which comes through chemical doping versus that of field doping. So one example for this. Say coupling to the lattice distortions is that size, the mean size, where you would have a localization transition in between doping 0.13 and 0.14. Now assume chemical doping at 0.13. So it's still not localized. Then your field-induced charge, field doping, as I said, with increasing field, the localization effect decreases. So it stays actually superconducting until at some much higher value of doping it breaks down. On the other hand, if you go with chemical doping to 0.14, you are already in a localized state. Then through the excitonic effect, you delocalize, you induce more and more charge carriers until finally you have, again, localization. So obviously, the situation is very complicated. It's also complicated that, for instance, for underdoped systems and overdoped systems, it's not symmetric. For instance, that might explain the fact that you didn't find major TC shifts for overdoped systems, and possibly there's more to come. Thank you for your attention.
Yes.
A fit mechanism. By the time the coupling got cranked up into the regime, it also was hard to achieve because of the distance separation. So there's always a danger of CW taking over.
We've checked this a little bit, and it turns out that there is a tendency for small two-level splitting. However, if the two-level splitting is increased above one electron volt, two electron volts of that size, then we avoid that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, my usually doesn't work unless I plug it in and then turn on my computer. So that's it. Okay, so well, this is where I'm from, and well, this is loading. So I decided to tell a story about a few more aspects of this tau 1 scattering. What happens if we solely have a scattering in the off-diagonal channel? So let me just see what the title actually is. Okay, here we go. Coming. Okay. So more on this off-diagonal scattering in the cuprates. And so I will focus on the point. Okay, I'll focus on this inhomogeneity and on the famous zero bias conductance peak as well in observed near zinc in BISCO. So the question is really like, how much can we understand of the Davis STM experiments in BISCO solely from Andreev scattering and Andreev physics? Knowing, of course, that's not the only thing that's happening, but maybe to some extent that's dominating in the future. And so so this work is done in collaboration with Ashot Melikian and Tamara Nuna, Peter Hirschfeld, and we are all from the University of Florida. Okay, so when I made these slides, I figured out it was impossible not to tell a relatively coherent story without having a little bit of overlap from what we heard last week. So there will be some overlap, and everyone was not here. So I will have, at least in the first 5 minutes, some overlap with these experimental results and the gap maps and the evidence for this nanoscale inhomogeneity. Introduce this model again, only taking into account this off-diagonal scattering, and compare some new correlations that we found this week. A lot of this was actually talked about in Tamara's talk last week, so there will also be a little bit of overlap here. Tamara talked a lot about why the conventional potential scattering model didn't work for us. We tried a very long time to actually get it to work, and it's relatively simple to understand why it didn't work at this level, but I won't really discuss that. And then this will bring me back to the, we can understand all of this in terms of Andreev physics from a single point-like perturbation in the gap. And this then brings me to the STM experiments on these zero bias conductance peaks near zinc impurities. And the question, there's some proposal here that maybe we can actually understand this in terms of something that we call phase impurities, which means that this state is an Andreev state.
Zero bias, you mean? Really zero?
No. Minus what? Yeah, minus 2 MeV or something. That's
almost
zero, yes. So this is a talk on cuprates, and question is, you know, what happens when we stuff extra oxygen into the penthouse apartment of this unit cell? And the fascinating thing here is, of course, you know, that when to get all the interesting effects on the superconducting state and so on, we will always induce disorder. And we don't know where the oxygens go, really. And this is what we saw several times last week. This is X and Y, and Davies and McElroy and collaborators put their STM chip and scan as a function of bias, and then they measure the distance between the coherence peaks, that's 2 delta, and they do this in, as a function of space for various doping levels. This is, I think, optimal doping, and then you go to underdoping, and you see these, this is what we call the inhomogeneity here, you see these patches in the gap maps of very sort of well-defined, rapidly changing amplitudes of the gap. An interesting thing is that if you measure the LDOS here, for instance, in this red spot and in this red spot and in one of these red spots, pretty much doesn't change very much. You get this red curve. On the other hand, if you do it in some of the other patches, you get this is the experimental result. And an interesting thing here is that this is a mystery that's been around for a while. Why? How come these are so sharp and in these small gap regions as opposed to the large gap regions? So very recently, I guess half a year ago or something, they managed, again these guys, to locate a very sharp resonance at the, well, not very sharp actually, but the resonance in real space here at minus 960 millivolts. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, at least, that this is the oxygen dopants. And then you actually have, you know, you can put in the oxygen dopants into these pictures. I didn't do it, but you can do it. And then the theorists, you know, are in business, because then we can try and model all of these impurities with various potentials and see if we can match it with the gap maps. And what they find in addition is actually that there's this positive correlation between the position of the oxygens and the gap map. It means that wherever you have a patch, where you have a large gap, there's a higher probability of finding oxygen atoms there, oxygen dopants. On the other hand, you'll see the correlation from here that if you have these small gap regions, these peaks should be very pronounced. Something that we didn't really talk a lot about last week, but I think there's actually a lot more information contained in these curves. This is the correlation function between the LDOS and the position of the oxygen atoms. So if you, so the correlation function means you just imagine you take like two 2D pictures like this, calculate the correlation, and then there's a distance, meaning that if you start shifting these two away from each other, then what happens to this correlation? This is what this distance means. And they drop down at some scale characteristic of the size of these patches. Here, on the other hand, we plot as a function of this is the experimental result, they plot as a function of the bias voltage. So they have a 2D map of this LDOS as well, and then they correlate it with the oxygen positions for both positive bias and a negative bias, and they get this kind of curve. Pretty much the same for the...
R equals zero, meaning...
This is the R equals zero, yeah, where they just sort of right on top of each other, and they get this kind of result. But this is again an evidence for this particle hole symmetry that we've talked about at low energy in this regime here. Okay, so we tried a long time to just to say, okay, let's just model this in terms of this Hamiltonian. This is all of them I'm talking about is phenomenology here. Is it possible for us to get the basic correlations out here and some typical band structure relevant for the optimal doped case? And usually, if you include this guy, you know, the changes in your gap is just slaved to whatever you put in the tau 3. So often the Andreev physics is masked by the potential scattering. So if you, on the other hand, completely remove this guy and just assume that the oxygen dopants change the pair interaction, enhance it, then your results, your LDOS and so on, will just reflect this Andreev physics. And so this is what we'll do in the next slides. And so we solve these the resulting BDG equations from this Hamiltonian on some large lattices. And so I should mention that this there's some papers on twinning plane superconductivity where they actually do the same kind of idea, but within the Ginzburg-Landau approach. Okay. How am I doing on time? I have. Okay. Okay. So this is what comes out if you do it, and you can sort of roughly see high coherence peaks in the low gap regions, and this is our gap map that comes out, and this is the plot the height of these guys. Tamara showed this several times last week, and if you correlate it more quantitatively, you get this large negative correlation that just shows this. These guys are sharp, these guys are broad. So most of the things, a lot of things come out. Of course, in this model, you trivially get this correlation because it's put in by hand that wherever you have oxygen, you increase the delta. So the question is, what about this guy?
Will you also increase the delta some
places? No, we thought about that. And if from a physical point of view, it might make a lot of sense to do that. But we haven't done it yet. Yeah.
Well, I guess you can show they get one and two. In the model, what they do again, you just put the, because it's only potential. Are you talking about the results of potential scattering, or are you talking about tau 1?
I'm talking about tau 1 now. What we do, let me just say what we do. What we do is that, so from now on, forget about this guy. Okay, we have just assumed that G has some dependence. We put in actually a Yukawa potential dependence. Put the oxygens out of the plane, and say, okay, it's increased by some factors locally, and then we can vary, you know, the width and the strength of these guys. Okay, so this is what McElroy sent us last week. If they plot, can you saw just a second ago, here, this is the same guy now, just plotted over longer energy scale, and and you know, not folded back, with these kinds of wings. And again, the first striking thing is this is very bias symmetric. Now, if we try to do it, okay, I told you to forget about the potential scattering a little too early. If you try to just model this again with this with tau 3, you immediately get something that's very asymmetric. This is what we always get. And this, of course, it is built into the whole Nambu space physics.
So that's the.
Oh, sorry. This is the correlation between the LDOS and the positions of the oxygens as a function of energy. So at each energy, they have some 2D map. They correlate that with the oxygen positions. And that gives you some point here, and then they do it for various energies.
You said it's fine, but if it's not, is it possible to write down this relation function?
No, it's not. I think it's the...
One is the function of voltage and everything, another one is just duration.
Yeah. This is one of the older slides. This is the guy they calculate. So delta, so one of these will be LDOS, and one of these will be the position of the oxygen atom. And this is only at some fixed position, I so don't...
J to be zero.
J to be zero, yeah.
F is a function of voltage, and employing it as a function of voltage on the same side.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So delta F of
voltage,
delta G, at the same voltage?
Just gives you the oxygen position, so that doesn't change. That doesn't depend on the voltage.
G is then supposed to be one in some place, zero in
some place.
So
yeah.
It's just a one or zero type thing?
Well, to be honest, I don't really know.
So it's like a bunch of Lorentz and
a bunch of Lorentz. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, so this guy is normalized by these guys. So if it's completely correlated, you get 1. If it's completely anticorrelated, you get minus 1.
Okay,
and so so this is what we get if we calculate it in the purely this Andreev scattering channel, that it actually is very symmetric here. And the height of this middle bump here we can't get unless we include some very small but realistic percentage of unitary scatterers. Yeah. Well, that's what we did, but I think it's the important thing is just that. Well, yes, it has to probably to be strong scatterers because they need to just mainly reflect it at low energy. So that's what we did and we get this kind of thing.
So there any significance to positive correlation
at 0 guys? Is there any what, sorry? This here? Or?
In your results, say it's always negative, right?
Oh, yeah. Actually, so you know, these calculations take 5 days to do. So we just had one that was ready where we had some of these guys and put it in. I think.
Number of
unitaries. Yeah.
So can unitaries then, you know, the.
We don't really know yet. We just know that the details of what this actually is depends on probably the strength of these guys and how many you have and so on. That is fixed by experiment, and it's pretty close to this number, as far as I remember.
So, you'll probably talk about this, right? I mean, I have the minimum
voltage. Yeah. Well, actually, this is no. I'm not actually going to talk too much about that because we don't fully understand the shape of these curves yet. I mean, it certainly has to do with the fact that you need to get the modulations right of the low energy part of the D wave gap. There are some modulations there. And it comes out like this.
What does this picture change? I mean, you're doing the sort of the local correlation, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's a real chance that your model differs when you start looking at finite range correlations. Because Seamus's finite range correlation is pretty non-trivial, right? Just because he has. I agree that if there is an oxygen, it's over a black spot. But if you're at a black spot, there's no guarantee that there's an oxygen nearby.
Yeah. I mean, so obviously there are a few differences. And in our model, the correlations are always bigger than what he finds. But we're also only including this channel. You know, there are many other things going on in the real materials. We're just trying to say, from a simple model, what might be the dominating physics going on. So I, to be honest, I don't know what exactly. We haven't analyzed these things for too carefully as a function of shifting these maps. Okay. I think probably I should start speeding up. So this is what is the causing these things? And it's really is Andreev state formation, and this is also what Scalapino talked about or showed in on his slide the other day. That once, if you have a very short suppression of the order parameter, you start generating these very sharp Andreev states. And this is really a state, I'll show you, or a resonance. I'll talk more about it in a second. On the other hand, if it's enhanced, they're very broadened and pushed out. So how can we, okay, so now, so this is the reason we get the right correlation between the peak heights and the gap map. And now I want to talk a little bit more about, it's very tempting to keep tuning this guy, making it even smaller. And this maybe is relevant for some other experiments. So I have 5 minutes left or something like that, right? Okay, so I need to, okay, so this is now the do these STM experiments on BISCO as well, and they have a sink localized, some sink substituted site, and they measure the LDOS right above the sink. So I think the sink is supposed to be under there. And they get this very, very, very sharp peak that many, many people have discussed. This is again Pan and Davis and company. And so you get a very sharp zero bias peak, minus 2, 1 MeV bias peak. And the real space pattern, this is X and Y, if you're sitting right here, is such that it has a huge maximum on the side, and then you have to go to the next nearest neighbor to find the second maximum. And this has been very, very discussed a lot over the years. Velotsky and company, I think, were the first to suggest that in a potential scattering scenario, you can generate states inside the gap of a D-wave superconductor. And there's a big review now out about these things. There's an interpretation that this guy is a Condor resonance, and I won't have too much to say about this guy, but more detail about this potential scattering. The problem here really is that once you start increasing the potential to make this guy go in and lie very close to zero energy, and where it's really sharp, because the overlap here with the continuum is smaller and smaller, it's also very suppressed, because it's cost a lot of energy for this waveform to be localized on that side. So if you plot the real space pattern of this guy, it has this very suppressed here, and then it has the maximum on these guys. And how this stuff's calculated, you just have your bare Green's function, you have some perturbing Hamiltonian. For this case, we just have this term, forget about this term. Calculate the full Green's function. This is Dyson equation, this is the full one when you have inverted it. And the whole challenge of this is just to make sure to Fourier transform these guys and plot the LDOS. And so this is what comes out, and to reconcile this, for instance, there's been some suggestions of these filter functions, Martin et al., and some other papers, where possibly what is important here is the fact that you're not really only tunneling directly into the copper oxygen plane. So now the question is, well, could this possibly also be interpreted in terms of an Andreev resonance? Obviously, these guys don't look much like the experiments, because they are localized out here, and they're very symmetric on these sides. But the general formalism actually here was discussed in this paper by Schneerman et al. And there one can prove that this is a real and resonant state. You can simply go through this physics here. To get from here to here, you have to invert this matrix. Well, take this term, put it over here, and then isolate G and invert the matrix, put it back. There's some determinant that comes out of that. And this you can write like this, where these are the entries that enter here. And if you plot this determinant as a function of the suppression of your local gap, what happens is, so the poles are given by the zeros of this determinant, and what happens is that these guys are moving in, and that's exactly where the LDOS sharpens up like this. So if you keep turning this guy, what eventually is going to happen is produce these phase impurities. So what this is in the bulk, you have your minus deltas on these links and plus deltas here. But locally, after a while, calculation, we can of course do anything. So locally, what happens if you have tuned it too far is that you have switched these bonds very locally. And in this case, because of the band structure itself will actually break this particle hole symmetry. That was here. This is only for the particle hole symmetric case. Band structure itself will break it, and you eventually end up with this resonance here at very low energy, which, because it's an Andreev state, has the maximum on the site, and it has this real space pattern here. Oh, sorry. So all of this is the LDOS as a function of the energy, and this is on-site. This is if you're sitting right here and varying the bias. This is the nearest neighbor. So this is here, and this is the next nearest neighbor. So there. This is the difference between these three. And the difference between the different curves here is that the dashed line is the bulk, the LDOS. And then as you start lowering the local suppression of delta, you start generating these Andreev states here, moving into the gap. as you this and the difference between these various curves is simply the strength of how much you have lowered it. So roughly yes. So around here, somewhere in between this green and the blue, you are in this regime where it's completely suppressed, and then you start twisting it. So here, in these cases where it's like this, you have this local phase switcher of delta.
How much of a
tau 1 strength you have in your Yeah, so this, let me first say what this depends on. This depends on three things, as far as I've seen. It depends, first of all, on the band structure. It depends on whether you include tau 3 or not. But it depends actually quite a bit on the extent of this guy. Now, if you just have these four, I believe that if this is, you know, you say this is 1 here, then you're down here with 3 or 4. So it's quite suppressed. But if you include a few more here, just the next layer, then really it's like this. It's just a flipping of this guy. Delta. It's of order delta. Yes. Yeah. Of that order. Yeah.
As I recall, there was also a phase shift generated revolving around the impurities, right? So, but that was just that the magnetic impurity was
still was the response of tau 0. Right, one on tau 3, one on tau 1.
Well, but it was not derived either. So I'm just asking whether either of you can see a connection between the two.
No, I actually. Okay, so I'll just. So now I think it's of course it's very important to find various experiments that can distinguish between these guys, these various proposals for this, and. And Jörg actually mentioned a good idea the other day, what happens if the chip becomes superconducting. But I didn't think about that. Instead, there's some recent papers about this interference. You have these strong scatterers, and you have a few of them close by. The actual LDOS you should measure varies surprisingly much as a function of where you are. For instance, if you have two of these guys right here, and you measure the STM on that side or on that side, so that's what I've plotted here. Is the STM right there. This is for tau 3. This is where you, if you just have one guy, you have a sharp resonance at very close to zero energy. But now you have these two, and the destructive interference on both these sites actually is almost complete. There's nothing for the solid line here. Whereas if you have Andreev states, then these states, they will always split because you now have two of them, but they will remain very strong. So this is some theorist's idea about how to distinguish between at least the pure delta impurity and the pure potential model. Okay, so I think I'm basically out of time, so I guess I'll just leave these here. Yes.
While the experiment observed the Andreev resonance appear at those patches which are not close to the interstitials. Because near the interstitials you have the wide gap region without the resonance. But isn't that just the other way around? I'm wondering.
Hold on. Are you talking about this think stuff now?
At the positions where the tall ones scatter itself, then you will find the Andreev resonance.
Yeah.
Now, if I look at the Schrödinger's data again, the positions where the oxygen interstitials are consumed, these are the regions where I find the wide gap.
Mm-hmm.
So my problem is how to connect this, because I would say that the oxygen should be the sources of the 4-1 scattering, yet at those places where they are, you do not find the Andreev resonances.
because they go the other way. Because the oxygen, you have a larger carrying direction.
If the zinc is a very small carrying direction, the one
on the other side is small. So you have huge twice as big, but the formula is
science. You have to assume that there are two different classes of defects which
yeah.
are affecting the carrying direction in very different ways.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
One view affects two of
them. So the rate is right.
So what happens if you turn on the zero bias state, if you turn on, or a layer state, if you turn on the total with the potential, then you look at circles.
Yeah. So
I want to take you on. There's a growing problem for any of the tau 3 discussion about the zinc and then dealing with the cold shell and dealing with the universe and gravity. And from just one dimensional box working, either it's a main wall or it can go drive to zero in the node and the wave function. But that is what the sign is. So basically, you don't have a density there. Now, if you try to explain the zinc, its intensity in terms of like, having a very large and opposite sign carrying interaction there. What do you do with the tau 3 part?
Yeah, so the question, obviously, you know, there's some crossover, right? If I include the tau 3 as well, eventually I will return to your picture, your calculation. And I tried to do it, and it was surprisingly large, actually. I'm not exactly sure why, but the V is of almost of order T before this limit breaks down and goes over to. Yeah, the peaks, I'm not sure about the details of the peak, actually, but, you know, you eventually, definitely, you return back to the wrong real space pattern, like you suppress the... Yeah. So that was what I first... Yeah.
Obviously, you can feel things. And the question is how many of the constraints on the real world we want to tackle. And it's not only for you, basically. When you deal with the zinc or with some material, it's very hard for you to imagine that the solder coupling or that the tau 1 or gap kind of magnification would be stronger than potential on-site cooling plant. So the issue is actually you take the, you know, just like, you take the biggest energy scale to account for. Closed D-shell on the zinc side means that the energies we're giving are much larger than any of the gap corrections. So if you relax it, then it's terrific. You can do many things, but why?
Peter?
Am I allowed to respond a little bit? I think you're right. That it's very natural to assume there's a very large potential on the zinc
yes.
side. But as you know, if you have a particle asymmetric band structure,
yeah.
a large potential need not lead to a resonance of flowing energy. So you could imagine that all your arguments are correct, and yet, for some reason, which we certainly don't understand why it's complicated, this tau 1 mechanism is the more important one.
I'm saying within the realm of your model, the breaking out potential, at some point, this large investment will break down, and the question is, well, he's saying the door of key. I'm saying the problem is larger.
But it's not simply just the magnitude of the potential which counts, is what I'm saying. It's also the sign of the potential and the band of the system. So there's some details.
Yes, so it wasn't part of the discussion, but...
Okay.
So last evening's session, so I think I have a little bit short before. Colors there.
not shown properly. Okay, in the first line, I would like to thank the organizers, Jörg Schmalin and Helga Dagota, for letting me participate in this interesting workshop in exchange for giving a very short talk. So I'm going to talk about, so this is a work in progress. So I'm going to tell you an idea, and I'm going to tell you about some story. So there is a question, and I suggest the answer, and you can comment whether you're satisfied with this answer or not. All right. So this is a work done in collaboration with my graduate student, and the statement I'm going to make that in oxides, maybe quite generally, an impurity, like zinc impurity, can induce additional cross-stitching interactions. And I'm going to talk about simple antiferromagnet. So I'm going to show you some hints from zinc-doped lanthanum copper oxide. Then I'll tell you the central idea of that work in progress, which will require the three-band model, and give you some discussion. So this is who supports this research. So lanthanum copper oxide is perhaps undoped lanthanum copper oxide, perhaps one of the most studied system in among the high-TC systems. And we know that at low energies, it's almost perfectly described by nearest neighbor Heisenberg model on the square lattice. There are some not very interesting details like small gaps and further neighbors interactions, which I will mention a little bit. But so we know that at some high energies, there is a high energy model, which is 3-band, 5-band, whatever, 10-band model, depends how many bands you want to keep. But it projects down at low energies to very simple Heisenberg model. Okay, so now we take some copper out and put zinc, and zinc is the same valence as copper, but it doesn't have an extra spin on the outer shell. Okay, so the very initial idea is to suggest that some of the spins will disappear like that. So you will. So this substitution of zinc for copper will eliminate some of the spins, and there will be no antiferromagnetic bonds around zinc. So natural model one can think of for the zinc-doped copper oxide is this one, where P is either 1 or 0, depending whether you are on the zinc or on the copper side. Okay. So this is a model which was studied quite extensively a few years ago, both experimentally and theoretically, and largely due to the fact that experimental group by Martin Greven was able to create single crystals of this material with dopings of zinc up to the percolation threshold and even beyond. And this there was also some other experimental work. There was theoretical work using some spin wave type calculations plus T-matrix. There was also numerical work by Sandvik using Monte Carlo. And they all led to a very nice comparison, I would say, which overall showed a very nice agreement of experiment and the theory. So what this is one of the graphs from one of the works by Martin Grimmins' group. It shows the on-site magnetization normalized to its undoped value as a function of doping, zinc doping. Okay. So this dashed line shows you what, and it only measures the magnetic sites. So I only take into account magnetic sites. Okay. So this dashed line shows you what would happen if this magnet would be classical. If you would just dilute Ising system, for instance. Okay. So it just takes into account the depletion fraction of the infinite cluster. Okay, so the story for spin 1/2 system is certainly different. So there is a significant decline of the order parameter as you dope it, as you dope the system. And overall, it looks like the theory. So there is this blue line here, which is from spin wave calculations, which agrees extremely well with Monte Carlo calculations up to say 10% to 15%, which is a very encouraging agreement. And so there is a bunch of MQR and neutron scattering data, which altogether they more or less go all together. But there is one question here: is that
this experimental data seem to be always below theoretical results. And to show it more explicitly, I would like to zoom this corner. And this dashed line is the fitting curve for the experimental data. And this is the Monte Carlo data. So if I put tangents here for to the point of origin, the meaning of this of these slopes is the following. It shows you the slope of each of those lines shows me how much of the order parameter is suppressed by single impurity beyond the fact that you remove one of the spins. Okay, and you can see that those slopes are quite different. I don't remember exact numbers, but it's for the theory it's probably 0.7. For the experiment it's more like 1.1 and 1.2. So the ratio of those slopes is 1.6. So it's certainly not satisfactory for a theory which pretends to be a qualitative theory for a quantitative theory for this material. And it was quite puzzling because there was essentially no explanation for such an effect. We can try some. And one of the natural suggestions again would be to add more further nearest neighbors to the original model. So let's suggest that we don't start from a pure Heisenberg model, nearest neighbor Heisenberg model, but we add something else to it. And first thing to add is J1 and J prime and J double prime terms to further nearest neighbors, which of course are frustrating, and therefore they tend to reduce magnetization, the on-site magnetization. Okay. So now let's just think very qualitatively, what happens if you add zinc there, if you remove one of the spins? And you immediately realize that you don't only break good bonds, J, nearest neighbor bonds, but you also break further nearest interactions. So you break bad bonds. So effectively, you may expect that the local order parameter might be even improved in comparison with nearest neighbor mode. And you can put it a different way. You can put it this way. Those frustrating interactions will necessarily lead to decrease of the on-site magnetization for the undoped system. Therefore, they will reduce denominator for this axis. So if this would be a mechanism, you would actually expect that experimental points would be above the theoretical lines. Okay. And another fact is that even theoretically, if you take realistic parameters and try to calculate those J prime and J double prime, they are too small. They are of the order of a couple of percent of J. So even if you play with them, you don't expect such huge effect as 1.6. Right? All right. So this doesn't work. So the question is, okay, well, we probably should go back to one of those high energy models and see what happens there. So the first suggestion is just to assume that we are dealing with mapping from simple Hubbard model and see what could be different there. So you have a square lattice, you have Hubbard model, so you have Hubbard gap at each side. And you replace one of the sides by zinc, which is electronically can be considered as completely inert, so that there's nothing close to the Fermi level there. So you populate it at half filling, one spin per side. You let them fluctuate through the gap, and the only thing you can acquire is a super exchange. So you will be depending on how many T primes, T double primes you have in the system, you will generate the same Heisenberg model with next nearest neighbors. Interactions. So plus dilution. So it will be the same picture as in the previous slide. So again, this wouldn't work. All right?
That's why you could do double exchange through zinc orbital channel because
there are somewhere.
The gap is also a couple of electron volts, right? So
yeah.
Zinc orbital is going to be roughly in the same range.
No. Zinc doesn't. Okay. Zinc is way, way away from any relevant orbital, as far as I know. It's several electron volts, and it doesn't couple too. Copper has d orbital, which couples naturally with oxygen, and I don't think it's true for zinc.
So you can build through zinc to the neighbor copper.
Okay, you okay? When you develop your theory, you give a talk, okay? All right. So I give you a different suggestion, right? So let's look at the from the point of view of the three-band Hubbard model. And the point is that in three-band Hubbard model, there is one more degree of freedom, namely oxygen. Okay, and there was quite significant set of works in the beginning of 90s when people tried to check whether the simple single-band Hubbard model is similar to the three-band Hubbard model in the sense of its low energy limit. And the way the mapping of the three-band Hubbard model onto its low energy limit goes, it requires an additional step. And this step is to recognize that each copper has four nearest neighbor oxygens. And actually, it's natural to suggest that it would like to keep those oxygen states with it. But unfortunately, it has to share it with the nearest copper. So each oxygen has to be shared between two coppers. And way to resolve it is just to cut each oxygen in half. And the legitimate procedure of doing that is called Vanier orthogonalization. So it can be done smoothly without any problem. So you basically map the three-band model onto what I would call the multi-orbital TT prime UU prime model. Okay, I'll tell you in detail in a little bit more detail what this UU prime are. So you basically end up rewriting. There is no approximation on this step. Rewriting this original three-band Hubbard model onto the model which contains an effective sites or effective clusters, if you want. There are transitions between those sites, those TT prime terms. And there's a bunch of states on each of those clusters, which are some combinations of original copper and oxygen state. Okay. All right. So how do those states look like? Well, instead of having one single particle state and one two-particle state, like doublet and singlet for the single-band Hubbard model, you have several single particle states, and you have for three-band, I believe it was eight or nine two particle states. They're not all equivalent. There is the point is that if you take the lowest state in each of those subsectors, they are similar, if not identical, to the ones in the single-band Hubbard model. So naively, you can just cross out all the rest, and you are back to the single-band Hubbard model. And then the mapping on the low-energy model goes the same way. You perform the canonical transformation, and you obtain TJ light model. And for the hot filling, it will be just a Heisenberg model. Okay. So this is for the case of no zinc. Right. Now, if we add zinc to this picture, we eliminate one of the coppers. But there are still oxygen states around that zinc site. And those oxygen states used to be coupled to copper. And this coupling would bring down those states to make them lower here and there in both sectors. But now they are not coupled. So they are the same bare oxygen states which you would have without copper. Okay, so let me perform this cutting procedure, remove all the unnecessary higher states from each sector, and see what I have. So instead of the single-band Hubbard model with zinc, this empty, electronically empty site, I have what I would like to call T epsilon U model. So instead of, on each zinc-like cluster, I have an extra state here. So what would it lead to? At half filling, here I have the fluctuation across the gap, and I have super exchange, which, depending on how far you can go, generates J, J prime, and J double prime. In this case, you have the same type of fluctuation across the gap. So this is just to clarify what this model is. So you have usual Hopping, usual Hubbard term, and you have epsilon n, where epsilon is zero for copper, and some value for zinc-like site. So you have the same fluctuation which generates super exchange between the copper-copper sites, but you also have this process. So you have additional stepstone in between on the zinc site, which let those two copper sites communicate between each other. And since it's half filling and this level is depleted, it's not populated. Okay. So removing copper somehow
allowed you to have an extra state in between those Cooper sites. Okay, so what would it lead to at low energies? It's simple. You have the same Heisenberg term between the nearest neighbors. But now you have zinc-generated super exchanges between the sites which are adjacent to zinc. Okay, so you have virtual paths this way and back, virtual paths this way and back, and you have virtual paths this way. There is altogether six such exchanges. Okay, one can make an estimate of such a term. Now, in the usual Hubbard, single bump Hubbard model, the small parameter is T over U. Okay, now the smallest of this zinc-generated term, super exchange, is not T over U, it's T over epsilon, roughly. So you can take epsilon roughly equal to half of U, okay, to make things simple. And this estimate, so you can then estimate what would be the value of J prime over this thing generated J prime over J, and some realistic numbers give you 10%, 10 to 20%. And as I said, there are six of such exchanges, so you have an effect of the order of J pure impurity. Okay, so this is a drastic effect. All right, so this is my idea, and so the interesting effect is that normally if you just take a high-energy single-band Hubbard model, map it on its low-energy limit, and there is a small parameter T over U, you can forget about further exchanges just because they are too small. But giving an impurity to the system, having oxygen surrounding magnetic sites, you generate additional interactions or enhance those additional interactions. So in my view, it should explain this discrepancy of the theory with experiment, because basically, the effect of suppression of the order parameter will be stronger. You generate bad, frustrating interactions around each impurity. So there is some outlook for the future, because there might be interesting questions in the rest of the phase diagram, namely what happens close to the percolation threshold. Because on one hand, you increase the connectivity of the lattice. You provide further interactions among the spins. But on the other hand, those interactions are frustrating. So you can generate a glass close to the percolation thresholds. Another thing is that the same mechanism should be valid, say, for chains, for spin chains of this the same cuprate family. And you know, normally you would think that you dope zinc, you just cut these chains in half. But in fact, what you do according to this mechanism is you create just weaker link between the further neighbors. So this may have some consequences which can be measured in neutrons and all that. Maybe very, you know, remote perspective relating to the previous talk is that in the whole dope case, maybe these frustrating interactions can lead to additional pair breaking effect close to impurity and all that. So that's it.
There was some evidence from the neutron scattering looking at the zone boundary that that's just another thing on your long list.
That's not frustrating.
It's not frustrating.
A high energy magnon needs an extra term to be fit by this.
The ring exchange doesn't affect this percolation problem.
Well, you just want to know what the magnetization was done through.
Right.
I mean, if you have addition, the problem is that okay, those interactions are there. What they lead to effectively, they lead to reduction of the on-site magnetization of the order parameter in the host matrix already. So when you divide mx, m as a function of x,
oh, it doesn't matter because you divide by the same.
You normalize to it. You normalize to it. Yeah.
Can I have one more?
If you're willing to
Were you able to get this 1.6 meter-fold difference?
As I said, it's work in progress.
Yeah. Can you show again these various curves, particularly close to the percolation circle? Yeah, that's good enough.
This one is bigger.
What you call classical is just
population
theory.
Yeah, just cutting bones, if you want.
Right. Yeah. And the Monte Carlo data, the green one.
The green one, yeah.
It's
spin 1/2.
They should, in principle, give you the same data if you're very close to the population threshold.
As. Same as.
That's the cluster one. The question is this just this very narrow critical regime, or is there something else?
It is first of all, it is a narrow critical regime, but see what you are saying, but I never. Yeah, you might be right. Yeah, but it is a narrow critical regime because there were some previous Monte Carlo calculations before Sandvik.
They were
actually giving different percolation threshold for different spins and different, but then different exponents for different values of spins.
But they were not in the critical regime.
Yeah. But the point is that you have to go low enough in temperature.
The regime seems to be very narrow. So this is what you have to conclude from this picture. You have some green and dashed lines.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And certainly, the neutron scattering resolution is much wider.
If I may ask just one question. So, okay, you say that you go to 3 von Mola and then understand all that. But I mean, so can you actually tell us what the path is? Because for super exchange, you need to take the selection from copper oxide, which generates simply fast wavelet, say, to oxygen from oxygen to zinc from zinc to oxygen. So I mean,
there's no zinc involved. There's only oxygen orbitals around zinc involved.
So you don't go straight between two copper sites, but you go somehow around this, or how do you mean?
Okay. First of all, I don't think it's the right language to discuss. Copper is and oxygen is not a very convenient language to discuss this thing. This because you have to think in terms of those orthogonalized orbitals, and then if you are there, then everything is simple. You have clusters, and then you go from one cluster to another.
No, the same thing should work, right? So I mean, you have orbitals to start from, so
all right.
There are overlaps between
orbitals. Okay, so in the ground state, if you think copper contains spin spends 70% of its time, 60% of its time on copper, and the rest of time on the nearest oxygen. Okay, so you may take it directly from copper, hope on oxygen, and then hope further.
So further means another oxygen.
Another oxygen to the.
So I mean, there are two oxygens which actually split part by zinc in the middle.
So you have some admixture of this spin to this oxygen, and you need to get here. Okay, you need to get to this copper or to this cluster. So it's not that far. It's here and back. Imagine you have zinc here, right? So you want to go from this oxygen to that oxygen. Well, you can go this way. There is no. Okay, if zinc is there, there is no hopping between those two sites. Okay. I can tell you in my language. So there is Vanier. There is always a Vanier hopping. So even between the further removed neighbors.
You get a moment on your dangling oxygen when you take the zinc out. There should be a moment on the oxygen.
No. Okay. So in the ground state, it's empty. Okay. But through those, so nobody's sitting there. When you populated it, you see there is nothing there. So this is a half-filling situation. So due to this virtual going through this oxygen, there will be some.
On the oxygen,
yeah.
There's also a distortion effect, right? Because the zinc is bigger than the copper.
Somewhat. Well, as you may know, when they achieve this high doping level by mixing zinc with magnesium.
Yeah, that's why the NQR data only goes.
Yeah,
way.
NQR, yeah.
discussed those things, Sasha and all the other speakers.